On this episode of Off Course Agility, I'm crossing the border to Canada to talk to my guest, Eric Brad. My guest today on Off Course Agility is Eric Brad, and this is the first time I'm crossing the border from the United States into Canada. So welcome to the podcast, Eric.
Thank you, Ed, and may I congratulate you on being perhaps one of the only people who can do this during a pandemic.
Thank you. Right. I know the border crossing from the U.S. to Canada, actually, at times, I know, has been very hard to navigate during this pandemic.
Well, it's been particularly difficult on my wife and I because we are the only NADAC agility club in the entire province of British Columbia. And so a lot of our trialing has been down in Washington State. And for the last year, that has been not possible by federal mandate.
Right. Okay. But that's on your side, I think, more than ours, isn't it?
It's an agreement between the U.S. and Canada.
Okay.
Right now, it's only compassionate crossing. So unless you have a family member who is in dire need or you have a pressing family matter, you need permission to cross the border.
Okay, very good. And now, British Columbia, I think from our correspondence, I believe you're in the Vancouver area. Is that right?
Well, we're on Vancouver Island, which is just to the left of Vancouver. So there's kind of a big island just above the state of Washington, and we're on the southernmost tip of that.
Okay. But that's not like Vancouver proper. It's Vancouver Island.
Right. Vancouver is part of what we like to call the mainland because we live on an island.
Okay. All right. I assume, are there bridges or do you do a lot of ferries or what?
It's all ferries. And one of the perennial political issues for us is whether we should build a bridge, and those of us who live on the island would prefer not to have more traffic here. So I think it's going to stay ferries for the foreseeable future.
Okay. Well, there's something very, very nice about taking a ferry and being on the water. It can be very relaxing.
Oh, and it's beautiful country, and the ferry ride across to Vancouver is absolutely stunning. If you ever get a chance to come out here, please come visit us on the island.
Right. I would love to do that someday. That's for sure. I will admit, I do believe I have been in Vancouver, the city, but I don't know if I've been on Vancouver Island. I would say probably not.
It's about an hour and a half ferry ride, and the ferries have all kinds of amenities, so you can get food and drink, and it's a good trip.
Okay. All right. Well, like I do with most of my people who come on the podcast, my first question always to people is really, how did you get involved? How did you discover agility?
Probably unlike most of your guests, for us, it was a survival mechanism. We had a Belgian Tavern who was about a year, 18 months old, who was starting to display some fairly serious aggression issues. And so my wife hooked up with a local agility club, presumably to just sort of burn off some of his excessive aggressive energies. And that was fortuitous because that led us into a lot of really good information about dogs and training. But yeah, my wife stepped into it first just to give a very active dog something to do. We've had Belgian Shepherds for 30 years. And if you know anything about the breed, much like the Border Collie or the Australian Shepherd, they're an intelligent breed. And if you don't give them a job, they can get into all kinds of trouble.
Okay. Yeah. I'm trying to picture the Belgian Shepherd in my mind. Because I do, when I think Belgian, I always think of the Belgian Malinois, I think is how you say it. Now, the Shepherd is different than that dog, right?
Yes and no. A Malinois is a Belgian Shepherd.
Oh, it is.
There are actually four varieties. The Belgian Malinois is the short-haired version. We've had Taverns, which are long-haired Malinois. So they're colored the same as Malinois, except that they have long hair. like a collie. And the Groenendael, or the Belgian sheep dog, as it's called in the States, is the same as the Tavern, except it's all black.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for that. I didn't realize they were all, you know, they all kind of, that's the thing with dogs and with how they, you know, dogs have been bred all, and I don't know what the word I'm looking for, but how man has developed all different dogs over the years. It's like there's similarities in the names. It gets a little confusing to me sometimes.
It very much is. And as Belgian Shepherd owners up here in Canada, many people say, oh, you have Belgian Shepherds. You should try a Malinois. That's a tough breed. Well, it's the same breed that we have. It's just a different coat, maybe a different color. That's all that's different.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that. All right. So that's how you got in. Now, it sounds like your wife got involved first. Did you both run that dog or train with that dog in agility?
Well, as I say, there came a crisis point at about 18 months where he was actually baring his teeth and threatening us at mealtimes. And so we had to make kind of a radical shift in our training philosophy. And we moved from more traditional force-based training, compulsion-based training, or what you might call balance training. We moved to pretty much reinforcement science-based training. So for the first year or so that my wife was doing agility, I was just following along and being a Sherpa and kind of carrying her stuff and observing. And at home, we were doing all the good work to turn Vince, the Tavern we had at the time, to turn him around and turn him into a different dog. And from an agility perspective, it was interesting because when my wife started, she was just sort of barely hanging on with Vince. And I'm sure you've seen handlers like this where, you know, the dog is barely under control and they're sort of out there doing their own thing. But as the positive training started to kick in, you could see a much more cooperative relationship starting between my wife and Vince. And it was really amazing to see. So within about a year to a year and a half after we started that change in training, by the time Vince was about 2.5 or 3, they were doing great things. And at that time, we were competing only in the Agility Association of Canada venue, which can be a bit tougher because it's more like the USDAA down where you are.
Okay.
But it was a great experience. And I'm going to anticipate your next question. How did I get into agility? Well, when Vince was about 4, it was time for another puppy for us. And everything we had learned by changing our training with Vince just seemed like, wow, what if we got a puppy and did all the right things from the beginning? Wouldn't that be an interesting experiment? And so when I looked at all the positive training stuff I wanted to do, well, what do I want to train this dog to do? Well, agility was just the obvious choice. And so our next dog, Tiramisu, That was the dog we poured all of the science and all of the behavioral training into to see what we could create. And it was just wildly successful. She was an amazing dog.
Okay. Right. And how many years ago was that you sort of started agility with Tiramisu and even Vince?
Vince, my wife started in 2001. Tira came to us in 2004, and we probably started training her midway through that year. So back in the early 2000s, almost 20 years ago.
Wow. And then when did you go to your first NADAC trial?
That was about 2000. I want to say 2006, 2007.
Okay.
Tira was just about 3 years old at the time. And we had heard about this NADAC thing, and we knew that the women who were putting on the trial I think it was Feel Good Dog Sports at the time. They've sort of dispersed and gone elsewhere now. But it was unusual. We'd done a lot of, as I said, the Agility Association of Canada stuff, and this was something new and different. It was over in Vancouver, so we packed up the dogs and we went over there. And we showed up, and the first thing we encountered was tunnelers. And wow, that was an interesting thing. I mean, there's nothing in the AAC agility venue that even remotely looks like tunnelers. And it was fascinating to us that the mood of the trial, just the general atmosphere of how people were hanging out and talking and laughing, seemed so different than the very competitive sort of feel that we had with AAC trials. And it just grabbed us, and we've done NADAC ever since.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting how different venues, with the people I've talked to, that sometimes you get that sense from people, because I've pretty much always only done NADAC, so I only know that world. But there is similarities between all the venues, but then there's people that have done different venues, they notice little differences. And sometimes one venue calls to a person more than others. And tunnelers in NADAC is definitely an interesting class with all those tunnels. The dogs do seem to love that class.
Well, I mean, you haven't really done the USDAA stuff. As you say, you've only done NADAC.
Right.
Having done both the AAC and NADAC, they are very different venues in how they approach advancement. You've probably never encountered what's called a refusal.
Right. I know of it, but yes, I have not.
Right. We used to joke about it, and we haven't done AAC in many years. We are strictly NADAC right now. We used to call that sudden death agility, because as soon as you got a refusal, there was no chance of a cue and you were done. So right. if your dog stutter stepped before the second jump, well, your run was finished. So we used to call that sudden death. So I think and it's true in the USDAA as well. So I think for us, that lighter mood in part came from the fact that, you know, there wasn't such a draconian rule set that could eliminate you at the drop of a hat for a small bobble in your handling. The venue, NADAC as a venue, just really to us feels very much like a partnership focused, a dog focused venue, where it's really all about having fun and trying your best to do your best without a lot of penalties. Yes, there are rules. Yes, there are qualifying scores. But, you know, to hear people clap and cheer on somebody, even when they're off course at a NADAC trial, is just a wonderful thing to me.
Right. Yes. The support from your fellow competitors, I'll say, is that's always the nice thing. And I find that often that it's very rare you don't find that at NADAC trials, that everybody's very supportive.
And I will say, just to add on to that, that I find that most of the NADAC judges we've encountered have been equally supportive. You know, they'll come up to you after a good run where maybe you've knocked a bar or missed an obstacle and tell you what a great job you've done or what a great relationship you have with your dog. So as a venue, I find NADAC very supportive, and their representatives, at least through the judges, have been great.
Right. Yes. So you've always had the Belgian. I'm assuming, based on your dates, well, I'll ask, Vince and Tiramisu, do you still have, are those dogs still with you, or have they passed on?
Oh, no, those two have passed on. Vince left us in 2010 at the age of 10. That was an unfortunate thing. Belgians, every breed has their health thing, and for Belgians, one of them is cancer, and that's what took Vince. Tiramisu made it for 15 and a half years. She was great. So she left us about a year and a half ago. And with her, it was just, well, she was 15 and a half and things broke down.
That's a good long life for most large dogs.
We had another Belgian Tavern, Mario, who unfortunately was only with us for 3 years. He died of a congenital heart defect. He and my wife did agility, and he was an interesting case. He loved agility, but hated being watched. So as awesome as he was in practice, he kind of folded up when he got to trials because everybody was looking at him.
Ah, okay. Interesting.
And then after Mario passed on, we got Rizzo, who was one of the Groenendaels, the black variety, like Tiramisu, who was a black dog. Rizzo was a great all-around dog. He did do agility with my wife, and they did quite well, but he also did tracking. He was a nosework dog. He was a great swimmer and used to go kayaking with my wife. He did, I don't know what they call it, scootering, where they pull the scooters.
Okay.
So my wife and tried his hand at herding as well. So, yeah, he was a great all-around dog. And now currently we have two Taverns, Six, who is our sixth Belgian, obviously, and Ash.
I just got to interrupt you there because my dog, you know, I named my dog Trace, but it's spelled T-R-E-S. It's Spanish for three because he's sort of my third dog. So there you go. There you go.
Great minds, Ed. Great minds. Yeah, I mean, we were tossing around names for what the next puppy was going to be. And when I suggested Kowalski, my wife said no. So we ended up with Six. And then she's 2.5 now, doing agility, doing really well. We're hoping she'll get to go to a trial before she's 5.
Yes.
We need the pandemic to be over.
Yes.
And we have an 8-month-old named Ash. And he's also a Tavern, and he's just starting learning on his hoops. And we had him on a dog walk for the first time last week. So, yeah, overall, agility has become, you know, my focus, as I'm sure we'll talk about, my focus has always been on behavior and training. And I'm something of a training geek with regard to techniques and philosophies. And agility has been a great set of behaviors to teach a dog. So all of this training technology that we have, you need to teach a dog to do something. And agility offers so many great, unique behaviors that you have to work with the dog to help them understand. It's been a part of our foundation training with every dog since we've had Vince. So for the last 20 years, every single one of our dogs has had some foundational training in agility, even if it's to follow hand directions or to attend to verbal cues. I find agility, even if you don't want to compete, you should get to know it and try and train some of the skills necessary because it's been great for our dogs.
Right. Yeah. The way I feel it just gives you the team sense with your dog. That's my take on agility, and it helps making that connection. My dog, he's more, you know, to some extent, he's my companion. And then agility is that thing we do together. But when you do it, it gives you that feel of that you're a team and it's a bond. And I think it makes your relationship stronger.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I talk about, I do agility coaching on Sundays. I have 5 or 6 students that I work with privately. And one of the things I always talk about with them is that there are 3 things going on in agility every time you come to coaching. You're learning something, your dog is learning something, and you're managing the relationship between the two of you. Because every minute you spend involved in that activity is an interchange between you and your dog. You're talking to your dog, and your dog is talking back to you in the way that they do physically. And you have to maintain that relationship. You have to reward that relationship, and you have to make sure that you're attending to their emotional needs as well. So, yeah, I totally agree with you. It's one of the great ways to bond with your dog.
Right. Yes. So before we move on a little bit, I just want to go back to NADAC a little bit.
Sure.
So in your area, I assume you have a NADAC club up there, which you mentioned a bit at the beginning when we first started talking.
Actually, funny you should say that. Feel Good Dog Sports sort of went away.
Okay.
About a year after we went to that first trial. The women who owned it sort of moved on to other things in their life. And I think they're still involved with dogs, but in different ways and in different places. So there was really nobody in the province. And as you might expect from somebody who is a geek like me, we became the only club doing NADAC. So our group is called Scallywags, And we host NADAC trials here on the island three times a year. So at a minimum, we get three trials a year. And during the pandemic last summer, we were very pleased to be able to offer people video trials, which could be done within the confines of our provincial restrictions. We had to limit our attendance and we had to set things up a certain way and have masks and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
But yeah, we're very pleased to be involved with NADAC at that level. And we've been doing this for about 11 years now.
Okay. So it's the Scallywags group up there that you have, and essentially you helped to create it. Yeah. And that's good that you were able to do some video. That it's good that NADAC, you know, opened that up some, and the videotaped runs have allowed a lot of people of the past year to remain able to do actual runs for cues, let's say.
Yep. And we were pleased to be able to do it in sort of a pseudo trial way, where we could have 15 or 20 people together, although we were at mass with masks and 6 feet apart. We could at least have some of that camaraderie that you feel at trials.
Right. Yes. And I'm going to ask a rather odd question right now.
Sure.
This podcast is going to release on St. Patrick's Day. I'm just happy. Just curious, Eric Brad, is there any Irish in you?
Kind of. Brad is actually a Romanian name. That's one half of my family. The other half is kind of a hodgepodge from the British Isles. So there is some Northern Irish in me.
Okay. Yeah. So, and on St. Patrick's Day, we're all Irish, no matter what you are, everybody's got a bit of Irish in them on St. Patrick's Day. Well, so I just thought I would bring it up because this podcast will release on the 17th of March, which will be St. Patrick's Day.
Well, I'm a big fan of the Irish whiskey, so I'll be raising a glass of the Bushmills on St. Patrick's Day.
And celebrating a little bit. Okay.
Exactly.
That's good. Now, I do want to mention, which I didn't do at the start, that you actually are a fellow podcaster, and right. You have over 140 podcasts that are out there. You may have more, but I don't always like research my guests, but for you, I actually did, since you had a podcast and I love listening to podcasts, I did sample a few over the years. And if I recall, some of the early ones were probably around 2011, I think, maybe. Is that when you started?
Yeah, that's right. In 2010, I was given the opportunity to do some writing for an online magazine called Life as a Human. So I was producing essays two or three times a month about dog training and dogs and behavior. And one day somebody said to me, you know, I'd love to read your stuff, but I don't have the time to sit in front of my computer. It would be great if I could listen to it on my way into work. And so I thought, all right, I could just do a podcast and read my essays out and maybe tag on a little bit extra information at the beginning and the end. And that was the birth of that. So the year after I started writing, I started recording the essays, and that's why they have the format that they do. They're 10 to 15 minutes in length, and they're basically me reading a 1500 word essay on dogs and behavior.
Right. And your description is quite accurate. That's what I would say. They're generally about maybe 15 minutes in length. I'll admit the earlier ones, they the ones that I listen to, they start off with like pet life radio or something like that. They seem to have a little bit of commercials at the start, but then once you got past that, then it's mostly just you. And like you said, you talk a little, and then often you're reading an essay that deals with what would you use for the description? I guess dog training and the positive reinforcement for the most part, and different subjects about that.
Yeah, before we get onto that, though, I want to address the Pet Life Radio thing, because it's a little bit of inside baseball, but it's something that's a cautionary tale. I contacted them because they had sort of a stable of podcasts, and I thought they would be a good outlet. When I asked them if they would be interested in my content, they, of course, were very enthusiastic. What they didn't tell me was that they were going to cut commercials into my podcasts.
Right.
So there were a few, as you say, early on that have that until I could get my legal stuff together and ask for a cease and desist. But I actually received no compensation for that. So
that's okay.
Just, you know, beware where you release your podcasts and make sure that somebody isn't doing something a little unscrupulous with your content. I was not at all pleased that they were putting commercials in there. So if you want the uncut stuff, I do have a website at caninenation.ca where all of the raw MP3s are kept available, and that's where you can find those without
Oh, sorry.
If that's my mother, I'm not here.
That is my home phone ringing. I'm so sorry. Usually I don't have a phone with me that's going to do that, but I think we're okay. I think I silenced it. Sorry about that, and sorry, listeners. Yeah, so that's interesting to me because my podcast, I don't have any sponsorships currently, and I haven't looked to try to make any money from it. So interesting tale of caution there from you. And you mentioned the website Canine Nation, and I assume that you created that website? That's your website?
Yes. Most of my essays still live at lifeasahuman.com. And that's one word, obviously. Lots of interesting content there. It was a website created by a friend who had this idea that if you could talk about various subjects, but from the standpoint of what it's like to be a person doing those things. And so, obviously, my slant was, what is it like to be training and living with dogs as opposed to a how-to column? Right. And Canine Nation came about as sort of a backup archive. I wanted to make sure that all of that stuff lived somewhere else as well. So in case Life as a Human ever died, and so far it hasn't, touch wood. And then I added the podcast there, and I was doing some additional writing under a different title called From the Hill. And then I started a series called Sensible Canine. So there's a variety of stuff at caninenation.ca. Both written and from a podcast perspective, you can listen right at the website.
Right. Okay. And I'll say that I did sample, as I said, a number of your early ones, and I sampled some of the later ones that probably must come from a feed from the Canine Nation, because then they did not have any advertising on them. It was just you for the most part. And of those, I want to ask about one, because on one of them, one of the podcasts, you were talking about programming yes. dogs. And in there, you made reference, and since you have a website and all, I assume that as an occupation, you've been involved with something with technology. I'm curious about that, if you would like to share anything about what your occupation may have been or is.
Well, I'm retired now.
Okay. Good. Good for you.
Thank you. No, my wife and I were in the IT business for about 30 years. Starting back in the 80s, we were both pulling coaxial cable and installing servers and law firms. And we kind of grew up with the internet. And I ended my career at Microsoft in 2002 after spending 6 years there as a consultant. My wife started her own business in 2001. She was a project manager and consultant for about six more years after I retired. But yeah, we were very much in the thick of the internet revolution and building the infrastructure that made all of that possible. For which I have to say, I feel a little bit guilty given all of the mudslinging that goes on social media. I wish we had used our powers for good, but it seems, yeah.
Well, there's still a lot of good that if you think about the pandemic and how people have at least been able to work from home.
It's you, Ed. I think it's you. It's this kind of content that is what makes the internet worthwhile. It's uplifting and it's interesting and it helps people maybe grow and think in better ways.
Yes, I agree. There's a lot of good, and it does allow a lot of connections among us humans and to learn. So, and during the pandemic, it's allowed people to keep jobs and everything else. Because I'm slightly in technology, not exactly, but I'm a programmer and I work from home now. So I may eventually get back into an office. But there's some advantages to working from home, and there's disadvantages, obviously.
It can be a challenge. It's interesting how our IT backgrounds, my wife and I, how our backgrounds kind of dovetailed with our discovery of behavioral science and positive training. We always had an analytical approach to our professional lives, and learning about behavior analysis and reinforcement-based training. Karen Pryor, who is one of the pioneers in positive training, always refers to this kind of training as a technology. And it really is, if you think about it in terms of a technology has a set of principles that it's based on, and you can get repeatable results if you follow the principles. So it was very much attractive to us as analytical minds to step into this kind of training. And then, of course, the blogging and the podcasting is just another aspect of our technology focus. And even today, we've gotten to the point where we have a little, I shouldn't say little, it's 32 inches. We have a 32-inch TV that we bring to coaching on Sundays. And we use the technology to video and do some analysis in real time. So we are still very much technology focused in our approach to dogs and training.
Right. Yeah, that's an interesting. I've never had that, but I could see how that could be useful. After you do a run, I've often had someone say, you did this or you did that. And I often videotape my own runs, but when I look at them myself, it would be maybe better to have the person that you learn from or someone, a trusted teacher to help you, point out, well, there's where you did, your shoulders are turned that way. That's why the dog went that way or whatever.
Well, you touch on an interesting thing, because this is where things kind of went sideways for me in the agility world. Tira and I took classes and took formalized instruction for about 12 months, and then we had to walk away. Because so much of what we were hearing in the agility world from our instructors and from other competitors was just not making sense when I put it up against the things I was learning in behavioral science. And I'll give you a quick example. One of the things we always heard people say about weave pulls, when your dog was struggling with the weaves and wasn't getting the entry, what the common thing people would say is, you need to say it like you mean it.
Okay.
Right. Make sure that and point just before the pole and make sure you say it like you mean it. And I remember reading in one of the essays I was reading about positive training that if your dog does not understand the cue, saying it louder is kind of like trying to order in English at a restaurant in Paris. It doesn't matter how loud you say it, they don't understand you. So it was that kind of conflict that I was running into, where I was being asked to do things with my dog and handling that didn't make sense from a training perspective based on all the other reading I was doing. And I simply stopped taking instruction. And everything I learned about agility, I learned from video and watching myself. So that's how I learned how to handle. That's how Tira and I got to 6 championships.
Right. Very, very good. More power to you. That's for sure. But I agree with, you know, what you're saying there. Like I have always taken pride in Weave Pulls because I've been fortunate. My first Beagle, he liked Weave Pulls. He did them well. And my guy right now, he's doing them pretty well too. And the Weave Pulls is one of those things like they have to figure that out for themselves. And once they do, and they do it consistently, it's like, it's really great because you're just like, yeah, you're doing great. But it is a tough thing for the dog to learn. And so many people have problems with weave pulls, but the pointing to where you got to go in that I don't buy that one. They have to learn to make those entrances themselves to some extent.
Yeah, weaves are interesting. I have my own method that we devised that's based on reinforcement-based training that doesn't use guides, doesn't use channels or anything else, no split weaves. It's just a set of poles. You start with two, you go to three, you go to four, you go to five, kind of an extension of Susan Garrett's 2x2 method, but without any special equipment. But it's based on three key concepts that I think you need to teach a dog for weaves. First of all, you need to teach them that the first pole always has to be on their left shoulder. Second of all, they have to understand that they need to alternate between the poles, the actual weaving action. And the third concept is to take every pole you see. So if you can communicate those three things to a dog and reinforce them independently, then you can teach a dog to do any number of weaves, 5, 7, 9, 6, 12, whatever.
Right.
And so that's the way we work on it. And even in practice today, I will go out onto a practice course that we've set up and I'll pull three poles out just to do it, right? So that my dog understands that it's not always 6, it's not always 12, but take every pole you see.
Yes, and that makes sense to me. The way you've described it does make sense to me, for sure. I will admit, and it's coming through to me talking to you and from my sampling of your podcast, and I'm going to give you a compliment because even on this podcast, I think people can hear it. You have a very nice voice, a very pleasant voice to listen to. You probably could have been in radio or something because you have a very pleasant voice.
Thank you, Ed. I've heard that before. And I like to say that I have a face that was made for radio. So,
and I've heard that before from people too. Yes. So, it's very pleasant. So I've enjoyed listening, you know, my random sampling. I probably listened to maybe 15 or 20 of your episodes. And I, like someone, you mentioned it earlier, I'm not a big reader. And it comes through that on your podcast that you've read a lot of books about dog training from different people. So I get the sense that you're very well read and you do enjoy studying on the subject of dog training.
I do. And in fact, I'm a professionally certified trainer. So I've taken the time to go out and get a certification from the Certification Council for Professional Dog Trainers, which is kind of the gold standard in North America for certifying that people know what they're talking about when it comes to dogs.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know how any of that certification stuff works. I know I see certain certifications in different fields and even in dogs. And I've never been that aware of how any of that really works.
Well, I'll put a plug in here for the CCPDT that I'm referencing here. They're an independent certification council. It's not one of those places where you pay your $4,000, go through the course, and they give you a rubber stamp. You actually have to go and sit an exam somewhere of about 250 questions, and they evaluate your answers. And it's something that I'm very proud of. Because it's not something I think everybody can go out and just pay the money and get. You actually have to demonstrate that you have some knowledge. And I think that the more we can move toward nationalized standards, either in Canada or the U.S. or wherever it be, and have people be registered, I think that's better for the consumer, so that you have some legal recourse. If someone says, I'm going to help you with their dog, with your dog, and they just show up with a choke chain, and, you know, God knows what happens at that point. You know, there are people who know what they're doing, and there are people who hang out a shingle. I like to be thought of as the former rather than the latter.
Right. Yes. Yes. And I'm glad to hear that there, you know, there is a certification that that means, coming from you, I can tell it means something. So it's good for people to look for that type of thing from Absolutely. From trainers that they want to use, perhaps.
I think it's important. You should be working with someone who is a professional and can demonstrate they know what they're doing. The certification helps, but also you need to be able to work with someone as a personality. So, you know, before you fork over your money, make sure you talk to the person and feel comfortable what you're working with.
Yes, that's certainly true of many things. Yep. A little bit back to dogs and agility. The you mentioned, you know, that some of your dogs have had championships. Did you ever attend the NADAC championships?
No, sir. Nor will
Never
I.
Have. Okay.
I am just not that kind of guy.
No, that's quite all right. I just like to ask people that. I've been there. I've never been there as a competitor, but I've attended twice as a spectator because my sister went. And I do, and especially since I'm talking to a Canadian, it's always interesting that in the morning when they start the championship, they play the American national anthem and they also play O Canada. So it's quite, you know, you're reminded that NADAC does cross the border between the United States and Canada.
It does. And I have to say, Alberta is probably the luckiest province. There's quite a bit of NADAC agility between Calgary and Edmonton. There's some in Saskatchewan. I don't think there's any in Manitoba. There are one or two clubs, I believe, in Ontario. And I heard through the grapevine that somebody's just started up on the East Coast in Nova Scotia. So, yeah, we're making inroads slow but sure, but we'll see how it happens. But as far as championships go, when I was with the AAC many years ago, I had the chance to attend a nationals with Tira and did not enjoy that experience at all.
Right.
I followed that on with a regional championship appearance, and just the environment, the pressure, it's not for me as a person. I'm not one of those type A people. I like to work with my dogs for a personal best rather than a comparative best to other people.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, to each their own, that's for sure. Yeah. But even at champs, I would say NADAC champs, don't get me wrong. There's definitely that more of that competitive feel than you get at a normal trial. But still, it's still very supportive of everyone out there running their dog. And that's really nice to see, even at the NADAC championships.
Yep. Honestly, Ed, I would expect nothing less. I mean, NADAC is a quality organization in that respect. And I have friends who are dedicated nationals people and like to go as often as they can. And for them, it's almost like a convention. It's a celebration of NADAC agility for them. And they always come back with great stories.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And going back, I know I'm flipping back here on this interview with you a lot, but going back to your podcast, some of them, I must admit, I enjoyed. You have some of your essays that I listen to. Being a person who likes to listen to things, quite a few of them did focus on agility. There was one that was very true. I think you were talking about Tiramisu, if I remember, and I think it was entitled like "Dancing dancing with your dancing and agility or something like that. You definitely had the word dancing in it.
That was called dancing at high speed.
That was it. Yes. Tira, you have a very good memory. About, yep. Yeah.
She generally moved at about 22 kilometers an hour. She was a fast dog, and you had very little time to fix things. That was one of the great agility lessons in life. Never change your plan. Go out there with your plan, and if it works, great. And if it doesn't, just make mental notes and fix it next time. Don't fix it on the course.
Yes. And I believe it was that one. And I listened to that, and I thought that that is just so true, because when you're and it applies to fast dogs, but it can apply to other dogs too. When you're on that course and, you know, the dog does something either because they're so fast that they did the wrong obstacle because you didn't get them to go to the right one. You don't want to like say to the dog, oh, you know, you don't want it to be bad, because you want them to, you know, enjoy this, and you want them to work with you the next time that you're on that agility course. And especially with fast dogs, when you can, you know, your reaction time needs to be very fast too, to help to direct the dog. It made a lot of sense. And from a NADAC point of view, I know one of the things when people have tried to teach distance to me and stuff is also clear. It's like when your dog goes away from you and yet they do something wrong, don't necessarily get on top of them for that, because you may want them to you want them to build that distance component, especially in a venue like NADAC, so they will move away from you, but you need to get them to move and then listen to you.
I'll share with you the dirty little secret that I always share with my students on coaching day. Your dog never goes anywhere that they didn't think you wanted them to go. So if they're someplace, they're there because they think that's what you wanted them to do. There is under no circumstances does a dog think, I know he wants the tunnel, but I'm going to take the jump instead. So it's always on the handler. So as you say, there's no sense getting on top of the dog if you're off course or you've done something funky. Trust me when I tell you, your dog thought that's what you wanted. And so that's why they're there. It's on you to make the change, not the dog.
Yes. Yeah. And that makes sense.
You're kind of nodding in an odd way. Did I freak you out with that, Ed?
I'm nodding.
Yeah, you're kind of thoughtfully nodding, and I'm thinking, okay, I've freaked Ed out. Yes, it's always the handler's fault. Always. The dog is always where you told them to go, whether you meant to do it or not.
Right. Yeah. I agree with you. I agree with you. Yep. However, I do run beagles, and sometimes their nose gets them. So when their nose gets them, I'm not, that's them. That's them. But they're, you know, that's the way it is.
Well, my answer to that, Ed, is be more interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
If dog smell is better. Sniffing the grass, then you're not any more interesting than grass. That's the only thing I can tell you.
Right. Yes. No, that's just one of those things. When you run with beagles, that's another thing you have to work with, is to tell, you have to be more interesting so that they forget their nose, that they don't care about their nose. Thankfully, my beagles have not had that great a nose that they've, you know, it's taken over them completely.
We all have our issues. I remember Vince was very fascinated by birds. And so if a bird should ever fly over a course, Vince would stop and have a good look. And then he'd go back to what he was doing. So yeah, it always happens, right? They're not machines. They're beings with interests of their own.
Right. Yes, that is definitely true. So, all right. Well, I'm not sure how much I have to cover with you.
Either a lot or we're done. One of the two. There's lots we could talk about.
Yes. Yeah. I must, as I say, I found your podcast that I listen to very interesting and very thoughtful. And I don't think there were any that I really disagreed with. It made, when I listened to what you were saying, it made sense to me. So most of those, you actually have an article on at your Canine Nation, I assume, based on my understanding of it.
Yes, every one of the podcasts has an associated essay. So if you wanted to read it, it's there. The wording can be a little different because some of the sentence structure doesn't read out as easily as saying it does. So there might be a slight variation in the text, but only in sentence structure and possibly the choice of an adjective. I'll give you a dirty little secret from my podcast recording. I have a particular issue with the word reward. So as I try to record my podcast and I try to say reward, many times it comes out roar. So I have to do it 3 or 4 times and I have to edit it. And it always surprises me that to read a 1500 word essay takes me about 40 minutes and it takes me another 30 minutes to edit out the crap. So although you say it's very polished, that takes a lot of work.
Okay, well, it doesn't. I will say, from listening to a number of them, I didn't sense that there was much editing on them, and they sounded very good to me. And I'd never caught the problem with the reward. When I'm talking to people here on this podcast, my mistakes are there because I don't try to edit anything out.
Would you mind if I asked you an agility question?
No, go right ahead.
It's kind of an agility question. It's kind of different. If I asked you what your dog's field of vision is, what would you say?
Ooh, that's interesting. I would say it's definitely more broad than mine. My understanding is a dog can almost see, not quite, but they can almost see like 360, you know, almost 360. I know it's much broader than mine. I think at some agility class, and I don't remember where it was or who was teaching me, they did some sort of exercise where they said, do you think your dog can see you here and here? And then I forget how it went exactly, but they were saying, yeah, your dog can see you there, you know, and I couldn't see the person who was like where the dog supposedly is standing that can see me. Does that answer your question?
I'll give you a little mental exercise. You're correct. And I'm surprised that you know that. I'm pleased that you know that. If you mentally picture a big X and at the cross point is where your dog would be standing, the top triangle is your dog's forward vision. And the bottom triangle is the blind spot behind them. And the two triangles on the side are what each individual eye would see. So the one on the left is the left, the one on the right is the right. The important thing about that field of vision is only that top triangle is where they have depth perception. The two triangles on the side, they only see in monocular vision. They don't have any depth perception there. So all they are seeing is motion, not space. And I make this distinction for my students because anytime your dog has to turn their head to look at you, when they look back at the obstacle, they have to reassess the distance because they can't see it out of the corner of their eye like we can. So I bring this up because I think there's a lot of stuff about canine physiology that should be playing into the conversation about agility training. And agility work that we don't often hear people talk about. If your dog can't see you give a signal, then they can't respond to it. And I can't tell you the number of times I have seen people try to signal their dog while they were right behind the dog in the blind spot. Or they've got frustrated because their dog turned their head and turned back and then ticked the bar. Well, there are reasons for that, and you can help your dog by just staying visible and being clear. And it's nothing more complicated than that. And also, yeah, if you think about that X, the closer you are to your dog, if you start to fall behind, the faster you fall out of their field of vision. If you can stay lateral, you can stay visible longer. So if you can have 6, 8, 10 feet away from your dog laterally, you can stay more visible for longer amounts of time.
Right. Yeah, I get it. That definitely makes sense. So what
that,
you're saying.
Understanding how your dog hears, and another interesting fact that was pointed out to me by a wonderful handler in Calgary. Do you happen to know what the most commonly given cue on an agility course is?
I'm trying to think. Here? I don't know.
You're close. It's nonverbal, and it's come with me. We always assume that the dog is going to move in vaguely the same direction we're going. And this conversation with the handler in Calgary came up about weave poles, because I was sending Tira to the weaves, and then because she was so fast, I was moving on to the next obstacle. And he pointed out to me that you're actually giving your dog two different cues. You're saying go weave, but you're also saying come with me and moving in another direction.
Yeah.
Is there a way that you can make it easier for your dog to understand which of those is the priority? And for me, with that handler's help, I learned to understand that you can do things with your movement, not moving quite at as sharp an angle or not quite as quickly, so that you don't distract the dog from what they're doing. But come with me is always a cue that we're giving, and it's important to understand how that's going to impact our dog at any given place on a course. Never give them two cues and make them choose.
Yes, that makes sense. I believe I understand what you're saying, certainly in regards to the visibility, and also in your own movement. I know, since you mentioned the weave poles again, often I try to stay parallel to the dog when they're going through the weaves, because I don't want them to pull out in, you know, a different direction, which is kind of going along with what you're saying. But yep. I can understand, you know, there's, you know, as you get up in courses like, you know, challenges, elite and things, where courses get, sometimes you may have the need or desire to move a little bit off from that parallel course. And yet it could, something like that could affect the dog, because you're moving away from them and they like to, you know, follow. Well, like, and you don't want to be saying, come with me, when you really want them to finish out their weave poles. Yeah.
Well, and like anything else in training, we can teach our dogs to tolerate different movements. Many people call it proofing, where once I say weave, I want you to stay in the weaves until you're done, regardless of what I'm doing. But that's a training process, and that's something you have to work on incrementally. It's part of what you were talking about with regard to distance. The more you get distance handling down, the less your movement is going to affect the dog. So yeah, there are ways to deal with all of this, but sometimes it's surprising how the movement is affecting a handler. I have a student who came to me about a year and a half ago with a small terrier that she runs, and just one of those handlers that is very concerned about her dog and likes to stay real close. And she was having all kinds of problems with weave poles, and it turns out that she didn't realize that while her dog was weaving, it was also very concerned about being stepped on. So simply by asking her to move 6 feet out to the side, her dog's weave problems went away, because the dog was no longer concerned about the flying legs next to its head.
Right. Yeah. Right. That makes sense. Definitely.
So I warned you when we first spoke that, you know, I have kind of a different take on agility, and this is an example of it. I don't read Clean Run magazine. I don't go through all the usual channels. I just think about biology and behavior, and agility is just another trick you teach your dog.
Right. Well, I hope your perspective is interesting to my listeners. That's for sure. And I, as I said, when I've listened to some of your podcasts, nothing struck me as far-fetched or anything. It makes sense. And everything you've said to me, for the most part, has made sense to me too. And
yeah. So, and Let me just say to you, Ed, thank you for doing this podcast. It's great to have something out there that's upbeat and light and more about the person and the experience than all of the nuts and bolts, try this exercise and set up this grid and all that kind of stuff. It's nice to have a podcast that's about the experience of agility, not just so much the mechanics.
Right. Well, thank you. And that's the way that is my take right now. It's like, I want this to be about the people and their dogs that come on to and be my guest on this podcast. And I do thank you for being on this podcast with me. One last quick, if you want to just repeat, where is your web? What is the name of your website again?
You can find most of my stuff at caninenation.ca, and that's the words. There's no letters and numbers. It's caninenation.ca. You'll find podcasts and writing there. I've recently started Substack, which is caninenation.substack.com, and that's a mailing list. So every 3 or 4 days, I'll be putting out new writings on there. The podcast, by and large, is pretty much finished. I don't envision doing any new stuff.
Right.
I'm enjoying chatting with people like you and Natasha Lewis, who just did a podcast with me on The Positive Belgian. There's lots of great podcasts out there. I'll be promoting yours in a future Substack article.
Well, thank you.
I thank you for having me. And I look forward to seeing some video of you, Ed. Make sure you get some stuff on YouTube.
Okay. I will see what I can do there. Anyway, I thank you, Eric, for being a guest on my podcast. And I look forward to someday maybe meeting you somewhere.
Indeed. I hope we can see you on the West Coast. In the meantime, stay happy, stay healthy, be well, and good luck with your dogs.
And I'm back with a quick final. I enjoyed talking with Eric Brad so much that we filled up a whole hour. A few notes. Currently, the Championship 2021 NADAC entry forms have been opened up. So if you are thinking of going to championships in 2021, that information is currently open now. I'd like to remind everyone and thank everyone for helping me to grow the podcast. I'll remind you, you can find the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, CastBox, and a lot of other places. And you can always go to offcourseagility.com, which will bring you to my Anchor homepage, where you'll find all the episodes of the podcast. My next guest will be in April, and that podcast will be released on April 21st, the third Monday of April will be my next podcast with a guest. As always, if you're going to a actual trial or doing some videotaped runs, happy trialing.